Ted finished up with Romans 5, verses 1 through 11, that section. And tonight we're going to begin to discuss verses 12 through 21, this next section. I don't think that the apostle here is introducing really new material, but what he's doing is he's expanding on something that he began back in the first chapter of Romans, but he's really, really kind of continuing an argument that Ted discussed last week. So we're going to approach this, and hopefully I can present an understanding of this that at least I'll give you my understanding of what the apostle is saying, and I hope it makes it clear. Let's just think for a minute about the issue of sin. The law tells us how we're supposed to live. The law describes what's good and what's right and what we should avoid and what we should be doing. And we don't always do that. We sin. We violate the law. And when we do that, the Jewish notion of coming to an understanding of my sin and trying to deal with my sin, the Jewish notion was that if you sin, you have to make a sacrifice. Does that make sense? There's kind of a common sense approach to this beyond the Jewish approach. If Ron does something, then Ron needs to make it right. If Ron was to do something that violated the law, Nolan, as much as he likes Ron, can't take care of that by doing something on Ron's behalf. Ron's the one that violated the law, so Ron is the one that needs to deal with it. That's kind of always been the Jewish perception of dealing with sin. It makes good sense. If I'm the one that sinned, then I'm the one that ought to make a sacrifice. And you see even David in the Old Testament. Remember how David had sinned when he numbered the people of Israel, and there was this horrible plague and people were dying, and David's going to make a sacrifice. So he goes to the threshing floor of a man named Araunah, and he says, "Can I make a sacrifice on your threshing floor?" And Araunah says, "Here, take my tools, use that for wood, take my animals, use that for sacrifices." And David makes this statement, "I will not sacrifice to the Lord that which costs me nothing. So let me buy it from you. And then I'll use those tools for the wood, and I'll use your animals to make the sacrifice. That's fine, but I ought to be the one that makes the sacrifice." And the Jews have this notion ingrained in them. I think it's also true that we have this notion ingrained in us that the person that sins is the one that ought to make his own sacrifice. Comments at this point. I have to go kind of slow with this because I think it's a complicated kind of argument that Paul is making. Yeah, Kim.
Say, I mean, not just us having the notion of this. Our legal system has stepped up on that premise.
Oh, that's true.
I'm the one that has to report before the judge. I'm the one that will suffer whatever penalty is determined. If I have to spend time in jail, or if I have, even if they pay a fine, if it's a minor or lesser infraction. But that's ingrained in our legal system. It's ingrained in the workplace. It's ingrained in, and so, yeah, it's a part of us. And you know, you said that it's kind of ingrained in the Jewish system, but God created that. God was the one that said, if you sin, he will make sacrifice.
Right.
And he set up a whole sacrificial system for that. So it's yeah, it's part of our DNA almost. And part of the way we understand the concept of violation of law, any kind of law, and the penalty that must be paid.
And we would be mad if, say, for instance, I committed a crime and the police came and arrested you.
Yeah, and we watch crime programs all the time where there's, you know, somebody falsely accused and somebody has to pay a price and somebody, you know, those kinds of things. Our legal system isn't perfect, but yeah, it makes you angry when somebody is falsely accused and they're paying a price for someone else's crime.
Right. Right. Ron, yeah, you had a comment. Or Bill.
Yeah, the circumstance when David did that was an extremely urgent matter to him. He knew he was causing the death of thousands of Israelites. And there was the angel of death standing between earth and heaven. He wanted to make absolutely certain this is on my back.
Right.
I did this. I need to make it right.
Right. And there, you know, it's always hard for me to understand. God gives David a choice, the three choices. He said, I'll do this or this or this. And David said, God, I'll throw myself on your mercies. Just don't let my enemies take me, you know, which is David paying his own price. And it wound up with God exacting a penalty against those that had not committed the offense that David had committed. So what's going to happen here in chapter 5 in this section is Paul is going to take that perception, that notion, and he's going to turn it on its head. He's going to say, that's not the way the grace system works. Okay? The grace system that Jesus came to establish, it's giving me God's righteousness, not a righteousness that I earn. That would be the old way of thinking. But giving me God's righteousness is completely not contradictory to that, but it's turns that whole notion on its head. So this is continuing the argument that the apostle started in chapter 5. Because chapter 5, as we saw it with Ted, chapter 5, the first 11 verses present the things that come to us through Jesus or by Jesus. You see it over and over again. When he starts this section, he says, therefore, this is on account of this, for this reason, okay? This section is a conclusion from what's already been said. And it is, if you say that the therefore is there for a reason, the therefore connects this section with the last phrase of verse 11, through whom we have now received the reconciliation. And he's going to explain how that works. The whole plan of salvation puts an emphasis on the thing that was accomplished for many by the action of one. That's the whole plan of salvation. And the Jews are going to argue it can't be that. It can't be vicarious suffering or suffering by somebody else. You sin, you have to suffer. And that's what they wanted to bring over from the Jewish understanding. And that makes perfect sense to me. Okay? I mean, I say it's the Jewish understanding because that's why what he's talking about here in Romans. But historically, that has been the basis for our understanding of justice. When I talk, and not just the Jews, humankind. Okay? So, look at the number of times in the first 11 verses he uses that phrase, through Jesus, or by Jesus, or for us. He uses it in verse 1, we have peace through Jesus. Uses it in verse 2, through whom we have access by faith into the grace wherein we stand. Uses it in verse 6, Christ died for the ungodly. Verse 8, Christ died for us. And then verses 9 through 11, he just piles a bunch of these throughs, bys, and fors. He piles them one on top of the other. We are now justified by his blood. We shall be saved from the wrath of God through him. We were reconciled to God through the death of his son. We'll be saved by his life. We rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we've now received the reconciliation. Okay? So, in this section here, 12 through 21, Paul links what happened way back when Adam sinned to what happened when Jesus died. And he's going to show how you understand there can be vicarious suffering or substitutionary suffering. Okay? This idea of substitution or vicariousness is something we saw all the way back in the garden. This is not something new. And Paul is going to explain that. So before we can understand really this section, we have to go back to Genesis 3. Yeah. Yes. This is the most complete discussion of it. Paul kind of develops the ideas that other apostles would have voiced.
I mean, it's quite the connection. I was reading it. I felt like to analyze it in that depth and to bring it kind of, I think, it's.
Yeah, it's not unique to Paul. It's something that the other apostles understood, and the other apostles taught the same kinds of things, that salvation was through Jesus Christ. It was by his blood. But I think Paul just explains it more completely. Yeah, it's this marvelous illustration of vicariousness. Yeah, Bill.
I think of the apostles, Paul was the one that was the most steeped in the Jewish tradition, the Jewish law, and understood where they were coming a little better than the other apostles did.
Yeah, that could be. Could be. It is the most concise, well-reasoned explanation that's all put together in one place. So let's go back and let's look at what happened with Adam. And this is, we're really just refreshing our memory. This is something that we know. I will say that this is not something that we talk about very often, maybe because it's a little bit hard to understand. And I have not often preached about this. It's been a part of my preaching, but I really haven't discussed it at any great length. So let's go back and look at Genesis 3. And we're going to look at the whole chapter, and we're going to see what happened when Adam and Eve sinned. Okay? So Genesis 3, starting at verse 1, the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which Jehovah God had made. He said to the woman, "Yea, hath God said, you shall not eat of any tree of the garden?" And the woman said to the serpent, "Of the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die." The serpent said to the woman, "You shall not surely die." Maybe the first lie that anybody ever told, but boy, was it a whopper. He says, "You shall not surely die." God knows. This is what the serpent says. "God doth know that in the day that you eat thereof, your eyes will be opened, and you shall be as God, knowing good and evil." This is what's going to happen if you eat it. Okay? It'd be like me telling, or like Kim telling me, don't eat the stuff in the refrigerator that has green stuff on it. When you do, you will get sick. And yes, I have eaten the stuff that, because I wasn't very careful and it had green stuff on the bottom and I didn't see it. Okay. God says, you eat it, you'll die. Verse 6. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and she gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. And the eyes of both of them were opened. They knew that they were naked. They sewed fig leaves together, they made themselves aprons, but their eyes were opened. So, what can we say was the consequence of them eating of that tree? And this is a natural consequence. It's not dependent upon a judge somewhere saying you're guilty. This happens. Okay? It's like if I hit you in the nose, your nose will bleed. Okay? Now, a judge might get involved in this at some point, but natural consequences, if I hit you in the nose, your nose bleeds. Boom. So what happened when Adam and Eve ate the fruit of the tree that they had been told not to eat? Okay? They knew good and evil. Right. Right. They knew they were naked. Their eyes were opened. They knew good and evil. Yeah.
Well, in other words, they do good people, which, I mean, I know that that's what this says, but they knew right from wrong.
Okay.
They think that they had done wrong. They didn't have to be told that they had done wrong. I think they knew it, because then they lied about it, which compounded it. But.
Yeah.
But I think that they simply understood something about justice, and understood that they had violated.
So God knew that when they did this, This is what would happen. And when you think about it, Satan's temptation is that's going to happen, and that's a good thing. You need to want that. But it's interesting that Satan said, you'll be like gods, knowing good and evil. So I just point that out. No, so here's the first natural consequence that happens when they eat it. Their eyes are open. They know good and evil. Continuing in Genesis 3. They heard the voice of Jehovah God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of Jehovah God amongst the trees of the garden. Jehovah God called to the man, and he said, where art thou? He said, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. He said, that's God. And God said, who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I have commanded thee that thou shouldst not eat? So, what's the second thing that just a natural consequence of eating? What's the next thing that happens?
Because even not knowing, sin separated them from God, even without knowing.
It's really interesting. They separated themselves from God. Apparently, if you read the first two chapters, God would walk in the garden in the cool of the day, and Adam and Eve apparently had a cordial relationship with him, and they talked like friends, and they ate the fruit of the tree, and immediately they died. They lost that relationship that they'd had with God. And because they knew they'd lost the relationship, they went and hid. And sometimes we say your sin separates between you and God. And that kind of, in a way, gives us an out, because we can say, well, God said that that's what had to happen. Well, that's what happened when you sinned. Okay? It was just a natural consequence. My dog does that. When she does something naughty and you catch her, she hides. We all do it. I used to get cookies out of the cookie jar in the kitchen. My mother has bionic hearing, and she could hear the lid come off of that cookie jar from the next county. Okay. I would take the lid off the cookie jar. She would sneak down the hall. And about the time I got a hold of that cookie, she would come around the corner and scare me to death. I'd throw the cookie back in the cookie jar. Anybody else experience that? Okay. When we sin, we give up the relationship with God. We just know it. I'm afraid I don't have this relationship with God that I used to have. Okay, let's keep going. Uh-oh, what happened? Should go back here. Oh, yeah, God's talking to the man, and the man says, the woman that thou gavest me, she gave me of the tree and I did eat. Jehovah God said to the woman, what is this that thou hast done? The woman said, the serpent beguiled me and I did eat. So what's the next natural consequence that happened? Again, a natural consequence, it just happens.
When you're on somebody
else. Yeah. The next thing they did was they shifted blame.
Can you imagine Adam saying, well, it's all your fault because you gave that woman to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at the same time, if you go back and look, the statements that they made were absolutely true.
That's...
There was truth in those statements. Now, that also means that they weren't standing up and owning their own culpability in this. But statements were true. And sometimes I think we might do that when we lay ship. We say something that's true. There's a nugget of truth to it.
That's a good point.
But
yeah. That's a good point.
And the servant, in some ways, what he told Eve is right. Your eyes will be open. You will know good and evil, the difference between good and evil. Now,
the thing is, you'll be like God. You're not going to lose this relationship with God.
Right.
Okay? You'll be like God. Yeah.
So I might be jumping to this. He then says, but Adam had a choice. Like, did she shove it in his mouth saying, I know what I just did. Here, you do it too. Because, I mean, Adam had a choice. He could have thought about it. Adam could have said no.
That's a good point. Adam is just as culpable as Eve is. And he didn't have to eat it just because she did. You know, my mother was fond of saying, if 1,000 sheep jumped off the cliff and fell into the sea, would you be with them? Okay. Yeah, Bill.
I got a question. We say, and I don't think the Bible says, they shifted the blame. It seems to me that both of them gave an honest narrative of what actually happened.
Yeah, but it was a... It was an honest narrative, but they were shifting the blame. Okay. I've been there. I've done this. I know how this works. Like Kim said, what I say has to have a nugget of truth in it. And I'll just tell you the nugget of truth. Really, what I'm doing is I'm shifting the blame. I'm trying to say, well, it wasn't really my fault.
Statements they made were true, but it wasn't the entire truth.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't, you know, where Adam said, you know, I thought about this, and first I thought no, but then I thought yes, and then she, you know, insisted, and you don't get the whole story, but you get the blame shift, you get the part that tries to take the focus off of yourself and put it on somebody else.
Yeah. Okay, let's keep going. Verse 14. After all this happens, now God intervenes. This is what happened just because they did it. Natural consequences. Now the judge is going to get involved. Jehovah says to the serpent in verse 14, because thou hast done this, first art thou above all cattle and every beast of the field. Upon thy belly thou shalt go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. I will put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed. He shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Okay? I have no idea how this serpent moved prior to this. I can't conceive. It was a snake. We know that in reality, this is the personification of Satan. I don't know how he moved before that. But the judge says, there are a number of things that are going to happen to you, serpent. This is not just a natural consequence. This is God saying, this is what I, as the judge who has the right, say to you, this is what's going to happen. You're cursed. You will move on your belly. There will be enmity between the woman and her seed. Or you will be at enmity with the woman and her seed. And the seed's heel will be bruised, but your head will be bruised. That's what God says. This is the sentence that the judge hands down on the serpent. It's not a natural consequence, it's a legal consequence. Okay? Okay. Okay, the seed of the woman, I think, is a reference to Jesus. And we would see that if we looked at other places. He is the seed of woman. And Satan was going to bruise his heel. Satan was going to hurt Jesus in a big time way. And he did. He put him on the cross. But when you think about it, when Jesus died, he bruised Satan's head. It was a fatal blow to Satan.
Just that reference that was meant by God can foresee the future while being in the present. Kind of like this was his warning, being in the present in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, if we went back to the first 11 verses, it is future and present. Okay? You're absolutely right. But this is the reason that Satan bruised the heel of Jesus was because that's the sentence that God handed down. Yeah, we could talk about
it.
Right.
And then this is like his fall from grace.
I don't think this would be what we would describe as his fall from grace. If that understanding is correct, that Satan did not keep his former estate and was cast out of heaven, I think that's something that happened prior to the creation of man. Okay? And so Satan is cast out. When God creates man, there had probably been some creative effort by God to create angels prior to that. We just don't know about it. Okay? And most people would conclude that Satan was a created being, an angel, who didn't keep his first estate, who didn't respect the position that he was supposed to be in, but led a rebellion in heaven against God, and God threw him out of heaven. So he winds up out of heaven. God is in heaven, and Satan is still opposed to him. Then God makes man. Okay. And then eventually when you get to the story of Job, Satan is presented as roaming through the earth and he's observing man. Okay. And he has some abilities. He can inflict some damage on Job, not unless God lets him. But he can inflict some damage on Job. And he does. He causes his kids to be killed. He causes Job to have these terrible boils. All of those things. And then there's this conversation between God and Satan.
So this serpent isn't, I mean, the devil.
I think that's always been hard for me. The serpent is the manifestation of the devil, just as the dove would have been the manifestation of God. Okay? But even in this manifestation, God pronounced a sentence on the serpent as that manifestation. So he's like the dove in that the serpent represents Satan. The dove is God's representative or the representation of God. Does that help? Okay. Bill.
This just raised a question for me. If Satan's already been cast out, and Job, how was he with the sons of God presenting himself to God?
Okay. Well, let's not get into a whole discussion of what happens further down the line. Okay. That's a fascinating discussion. I'd love to get into it, but it doesn't bear on Genesis 3. Doesn't bear on Adam's sin at this point. And that's what we're trying to understand, because that's the critical part of the argument that Paul is making in Romans. So that's why I say, hang on to that thought. It's a good thought. We could discuss it, and it's worth discussing. It's just not part of this argument. Okay? Yeah. Did you have a comment? Babe? Kim?
No. I was scratching my lip.
Okay.
It made a terrible auction there.
Oh, boy. Okay. Now, next person that gets their sentence is the woman. And this is what God, the judge, said to the woman. This is verse 16. I will greatly multiply thy pain and thy conception. In pain thou shalt bring forth children. Thy desire shall be to thy husband. He shall rule over thee. This was the sentence. This is not the natural consequence of her eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. This was the sentence that the judge handed down. Now, again, like I said, when God said to the serpent, you're going to crawl on your belly, I don't know how he got around before that. Okay? I have no idea. And here, God says, you're going to have pain in childbirth. I was in the delivery room. I don't know how that could have happened without pain. But apparently, it could have. Okay? And it could be the emphasis ought to be on, I will multiply pain in childbirth. There could have been some pain associated with it anyway. And, you know, as I was thinking about this and pondering it all day long and trying to prepare for this, I thought, well, you know, it could be that God created women so that their pelvis could disjoint like a snake's jaw disjoints, and the snake can swallow something bigger than itself. You ever thought about that? I don't know. I have no idea, but that's the best explanation I could come up with. Anyway.
Dean?
God knit them together so that women are going to have pain in childbirth. I'm done. If you ask me a question about that, I'm not going there.
Well, I'm curious. I would like to know. My mind says that she perhaps had children, but it's going to be worse now than it was before. And so I don't really know. I've wondered.
It could have.
We don't know.
You could be right. I have no idea whether she'd had children up to that point. I don't know when Cain and Abel were born.
I don't either. That's, yeah.
They could have predated this. Okay? I have no idea
Well, it's not that important, really. It's just a wonder of mine.
it just doesn't say.
Yeah.
Now, I can tell you, you know, if you were to unravel all of this into Catholic doctrine and Immaculate Conception and the imputation of sin by virtue of the sexual relationship, and that's how Jesus was born without sin and all of that, if you unraveled all of that, then you would have to say, well, Cain and Abel weren't born until after this. Because if you unraveled it all, and I don't subscribe to that notion. I don't understand it all that well. I don't even want to venture a guess how they would answer that. Okay. So what's the consequence for the woman? Legal consequence. Again, this is not natural consequence. Forgot to change my slide, didn't I? Oh, that's embarrassing. So, okay. What are the legal consequences? Wait a minute. There it is. Oh, that's the seed of woman. The consequences for the woman. What else? Husband rules over them. And there's a third one. Desire shall be to thy husband. Okay. Again, I really can't unravel those any more than that. I don't know how. So that's the consequence for the woman. Again, this was not pain in childbirth, or multiplied pain in childbirth, is not the natural consequence of eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. It's a legal consequence. Legal consequences for the seed of the woman. Your heel's going to be bruised.
Serpent's head is going to be.
Right. Legal consequence. It's what God said at this point would be the result of their sin. This is the sentence. Okay. Now, Adam, everybody involved in this gets some sentence pronounced by God. To Adam, he said, because you hearkened unto the voice of thy wife and hast eaten of the tree which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, first is the ground for your sake. In toil shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. Thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread till thou return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. So, what are the legal consequences for Adam?
It got a lot harder.
Okay. And maybe that's true. I don't know. Not having been through childbirth, all I've done is pulled weeds. Okay.
It would be a lot harder for him now because everything was given to them, their food and all of that was just presented in the garden. And now he's going to have to work for it, and it's not going to be easy. So it's hard work.
He worked. Yeah. He worked in the garden before this. He was given the commandment to dress it and keep it.
Well,
but he was dressing and keeping something that cooperated with him.
Yes, that's what I meant. No.
Now he's Now the ground's working against him, and he's trying to do it.
The fact that the sweat on his face.
Right.
That tells you that he's having to work a lot harder than he was before. And he's going to be thwarted with thorns and thistles. If you look at other civilizations where they did a lot of this aqueducts, and they came in and they put water in a section and they did that, you look at it and you find out that after a certain time period, the ground becomes useless. So as much as a man works to get it to go to do something, eventually the curse comes back.
Yep. What's the last legal consequence for the man?
What?
I'm sorry? You're going to return to dust. Okay? That's the legal consequences. Then there's this little interlude, verses 20 and 21. The man called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all living. Jehovah God made for Adam and for his wife coats of skins and clothed them. There's this little interlude there in Genesis 3. Now, back to Genesis 3. More consequences. But this time, it's not Eve and Adam. This time, it becomes humanity. Jehovah God said, "Behold the man." Okay, that's the man and the woman. The man has become as one of us to know good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. Therefore, God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. So he drove out the man, placed at the east of the Garden of Eden, the cherubim and the flame of a sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. So, what's the consequence here? Lost access to the tree of life. If they had access to the tree of life, would they have ever died? No. That's what God said. They would not have died if they continued to have access to the tree of life. But God says, you're not going to have that. You're not going to have that anymore. You have given up the ability to live forever. So let's just kind of summarize all of the consequences. We have natural consequences, the things that happened just because they ate it. Adam and Eve's eyes were opened. They had spiritual death. They lost their good relationship with God. They knew it. They went and hid themselves. They started blame shifting. Legal consequences. There were consequences for the serpent, for the woman, for the seed of the woman, for the man, and for all of mankind. And the biggest one that Paul is going to pick up and he's going to use here in Romans 5 is physical death. Okay, that was not a natural consequence of him eating of that tree. He did experience spiritual death. That's true. But it was this physical death that was a legal sentence that was passed upon him. So let's think about, and this is what Paul does. He takes this argument from Genesis and he compares it with the consequences of Jesus' death. Okay? So when Jesus is crucified, what's the natural consequence of that? Jesus died. Okay? That was not unusual. Thousands of people were put to death by the hands of the Romans. And there were others, that multiple thousands, that had been killed by crucifixion throughout history. It's not just the Romans. The natural consequence of Jesus being nailed onto that cross was Jesus died. The man died. So, what's the legal consequence? Yeah. His death is the sacrifice for my sin.
The Jews had lived that their whole life. That was, you know, I said this before. I think it's just something in 50 years, and all of a sudden you find out the truth of God. You know, you don't exactly change overnight.
Yeah, this was hard. The apostle is taking everything they've learned and turning it on its head. Because now we're going to have the sacrifice of Jesus paying the price for peril sin. Okay? And that's why the apostle has to reason this way from Genesis 3. Okay? So there's the totality of the consequences. And unfortunately, we are running out of time. So I'll ask Ted if I can continue this next week, or maybe I'll just dump it in Ted's lap. Okay. But this is what I want you to think about. No, I don't think I'll do that. I'll just leave it at that. Okay? And we'll continue this next week. And we'll talk about the evidence that Paul is going to use to show that when God pronounced the sentence of physical death on Adam, he had the right to do that. And there's this marvelous illustration of that. And everybody has to acknowledge it. Okay. Sorry. It's a good discussion. And you just have to take your time to work through all of this and kind of fix this in your mind. And I have to tell you, this is not. At one time, I preached this sermon, and this was the basis of a sermon. I really did feel like I had developed this idea on my own. I didn't think I'd read it anywhere. I didn't think I'd seen it anywhere. Preached a sermon. Guy walked up, and he said, "You know, that's the best explanation of David Lipscomb's argument on Romans 5 that I've ever seen." And I thought, well, that bugger, he stole my idea 100 years before I had it. So, it's not unique to me.